R. Murrow set the standard for credibility and responsibility in television news and documentaries. Findlay and Murrow first worked together in 1947, producing the very successful album I Can Hear It Now, a record album of history from 1933 to 1945, History Told in Sound. Findlay joined CBS in 1950. Over the next 16 years, he co-produced the series See It Now with Murrow, originated and produced CBS Reports, and then served as president of CBS News. He resigned from CBS News in protest when the top network executives went against his decision to telecast the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings on Vietnam. The network opted instead to continue with reruns of I Love Lucy, The Real McCoys, and Andy of Mayberry. Findlay has written, quote, "Because television can make so much money doing its worst, it often cannot afford to do its best." After leaving network television, Findlay became one of the architects of public TV. He's currently the Edward R. Murrow Professor Emeritus at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. He's the author of several books, including his memoir, Due to Circumstances Beyond Our Control, and two books about the First Amendment, The Good Guys, the Bad Guys, and the First Amendment, and Minnesota Rag. His book, The Constitution, That Delicate Balance, will be published in the fall by Random House. The book is a companion to his public television series of the same name, which will be rebroadcast on PBS in the fall. Fred Findlay is in Philadelphia to hold a workshop on the Constitution, sponsored by the Pennsylvania Humanities Council. Fred Findlay, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Ms. Gross. Good to be here.
When you first started in television, what impact did you think that television, as opposed to radio, was going to have on American culture?
Well, no one could know. I remember reading a British member of Parliament saying, "Television will determine what kind of people we are." And I thought that was an overstatement. I think it was not. And I think we've now reached a point where the blur between the program and the commercials and the music that most people, myself included, can't tell where one ends and the other begins. I think television is changing America, often, correction, sometimes for the good, sometimes otherwise. I remember Murrow sitting in a radio studio, makes me remember it, saying to me very early when we were first doing See It Now, and we're trying to learn how to use these tools, cameras. He said, "Wouldn't it be good if we could uninvent television? Radio was so comfortable." And he didn't mean comfortable for his sake. He meant that you could sit down at a typewriter and write something and then say it on the air, and the people would hear it, and their mind's eye would help the reporter. And that statement has haunted me through the years. And every once in a while, I listen to some of Murrow's old records, and I play for students. Sometimes I tell them to turn off the lights in the classroom, and I let them hear Ed's broadcast from Buchenwald in 1945 when it was liberated, 35 and a half minutes. It's hard to think of that on commercial radio today. And I really believe that his description of the liberation of Buchenwald is a better job than we could have done with cameras. But television is here, and it is determining what kind of people we are, and so we have to live with that.
You were in one of the positions of power at CBS Network, but how much power did you feel you actually had to control the direction of the medium and to allow it to be the kind of humanistic tool that you wanted it to be?
Within the framework of a given program, the head of CBS News had full control. The problem with commercial television is there's no airtime. I watched the nightly news last night, sampled all three networks, watched a little bit of McNeil there. It is impossible to do the news budget, which, as you know, is a term of art for how much time you have, all the stories in 22 minutes. You cannot do it. Now, when I was at CBS News, I determined what the programs would be. CBS Reports, we would do Harvest of Shame or Eisenhower Revisits Normandy or whatever. And Walter Cronkite and the producer of that program and I would determine about the nightly news. But the problem is not within the program. The problem is that in a sea of amusement, I didn't say entertainment, you have 22 minutes of network time. And yesterday happened to be a very big news day. The Nicaragua story, the World Court deciding about Nicaragua, the aftermath of the president's speech, the decision about what to do about the people who had been hurt in Utah by alleged nuclear fallout, a whole series of major, it was one of the biggest news days there were. And they had 22 minutes. That's what's wrong with the whole thing. I have to add that they used up the last 3 minutes. They did a piece on schnooker, which is a form of pool from England, which is a big television smash in England, and they used up 3 minutes of airtime on that, which I thought was almost irresponsible. But I never had any kicks about what I did within the time we were given at CBS News. My quarrel was we weren't given enough airtime, and I think it's to try to do the news in 22 minutes at night, I'm not talking about local news, it's almost obscene to say that, but there's no airtime.
Why don't you think there's more airtime?
Well, because airtime has become so expensive. When Alcoa sponsored See It Now that Murrow and I did, it cost them $15,000 a week. Today, 1 minute can cost anywhere from $60,000 to $150,000 in commercial. So that if one of the networks, NBC, ABC, CBS, said, we're going to do an hour of news, they could sell all the minutes, but they'd be selling them for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, where if they did entertainment, they sell them for a lot more. And today that ship has sailed because the affiliates, if they said, if they announced any one of the networks, we're going to do an hour of news, affiliates, most of them wouldn't carry it because when they do local news, which often isn't very good, they get to keep all the money. And when the network does it, the network keeps almost all the money, like 90, 95%. It was different in my day. So you're never going to have an hour of network commercial news. And that's very sad because with the failure of afternoon papers, you see that in Philadelphia, you see that in almost every city in the country today. Not all, but most. 95% of the cities only have one newspaper or two newspapers owned by the same family. Television is the way that most people get their news. And not to do it well is to endanger the democracy because what the American people don't know could kill them. Just the opposite of what we learned on our mother's knees.
My guest is Fred Friendly, if you're just joining us. Most programs on TV exist to turn big profits, but occasionally a show comes along that's done for prestige. What was the balance between profits and prestige at CBS News when you were there?
That's a wonderful question you asked, because I think that balance, that delicate balance, the fulcrum of that has turned a little bit. In Murrow's day, and therefore mine, but in Ed's day, news was not considered to be a profit center. News was what you did, like an editorial page. I don't mean that it was an editorial page, but it was unimaginable that you'd ever make money out of news. See It Now never was expected to make money. CBS reports, NBC white paper, the nightly news. Maybe you'd get some revenue, but not to make money. I know that one of the pioneers of broadcasting has said, he didn't say it to me, so I don't want to attribute it to a person, but one of the pioneers said the biggest mistake we ever made was letting news become a profit center. When you try to make money out of every given program, every given news program, you are going to season that program with those items which everybody will watch. And nobody can edit a newspaper or a news. That would mean that, let's take the Philadelphia Inquirer, perhaps the most improved newspaper in the United States. That would mean that Gene Roberts, the editor, would have to make his decision on almost every page on how many people would read that page. How many people would read column six? How many people would read that long, complicated story about deficit spending or about nuclear fallout? Well, we know that a lot of things that go into news are not going to be the most popular thing, but you do it because that's your responsibility. And if 10, 15, 20% of the people read it, that's fine. Television today, almost everything they do has to turn a profit. And I think that is the beginning of the road magnitude, a colossal defeat, because it's going to end up with what I call pop news, junk news. And I happen to be I like to think of myself as a serious journalist. I like to think, and I'm sure, that the Rathers, the Brokos, the Copples, certainly Cronkite, Murrow, there are a lot of very serious journalists out there, but they're not allowed to do their best because there's so much money, as you quoted me 18 years ago, there's so much money in doing less than your best, of doing your worst. And it wouldn't be such a tragedy if it weren't that news is the crucible of democracy. If you don't know about the world we live in and the fact that for the first time in the history of this planet we're capable of destroying it, how are you going to elect people? I'm not talking Republican, Democrat. I'm talking just as much governor, mayor, senator, congressman. American people are dependent on television. It's a sacred trust. And it's used really to move goods. And if that doesn't make one weep, I don't know what it takes to make one weep.
Do you think that the network news is already showing the pressure to get profits, as well as local news showing that?
Oh, yes. I think so. And if you watch the last, I suggest to your listeners, to you, watch the last five minutes any night. And you'll see it go from hard news to soft news, predictably, and with that intent, with soft news intent. And you see pieces that run a minute and 12 seconds. And you see pieces that are on the air just because they have good pictures. It's becoming almost a tabloid that where pictures can, that stories get on the air because the pictures are so good. And that was what tabloids were 50 years ago. As a matter of fact, tabloids have gotten much better recently. They try to be serious. And it isn't because the producers and the reporters aren't capable of knowing what they're doing. They do know. But if they don't come up with those ratings, there'd be somebody else there.
You quote Edward R. Murrow in your memoir, Due to Circumstances Beyond Our Control, as saying, quote, that there's no suggestion here that networks or individual stations should operate as a philanthropy, but I can find nothing in the Bill of Rights or the Communications Act which says that they must increase their net profits each year lest the republic collapse. Do you think that the networks want too much profit every year? I mean, that do you think they should be satisfied with some profit instead of with so much profit and doubling it every year?
Especially for entities which are licensed in the public interest, convenience, and necessity, and which they agreed to, the networks and the stations, when they got their licenses. What's happened, Ms. Gross, is that the value of a television station has increased geometrically over and over again. The station that I work for in Providence, Rhode Island, where I began, which was worth a few hundred thousand dollars 20 years ago, is now worth $40, $50, $60 million. One station was sold for $250 million. Station in Boston, pretty good station, by the way. The problem is that the people who are now acquiring stations and the networks which own those stations are bought by Wall Street. Mr. Paley, William S. Paley, said to me once, the biggest mistake we made was going public. That meant that institutions, mutual funds, corporations, even foundations, own the stock, and what they want is a return on their dollar. Otherwise, they'll sell their stock. And I don't think it was ever intended to be that way. It isn't that way in any other country of the world. The BBC and even the commercial companies in Britain don't work that way. But if you spend millions of dollars for a station, hundreds of millions, and if you own a network which is part of a big conglomerate in which every part of it has to earn a lot of money and double its profits every few years, you are driven inexorably to go after the largest possible audience all of the time. If the New York Times did that, the New York Times wouldn't be the paper it is, nor would the Philadelphia Inquirer or the Washington Post.
Fred Friendly is my guest, if you're just joining us. One of the kind of classic problems that you were up against at CBS is every time you wanted to preempt programming for a special news event, you knew that they'd be losing commercials and therefore losing revenue.
Well, and what's wrong with that?
Yeah, can you give us some examples in which you were at odds with the top executives about what to carry and what not
to?
Well,
I suppose the one that I remember most is the Vietnam War and the hearings. If you remember, in 1966, the Senator Fulbright had hearings in which he called Dean Rusk, Robert McNamara, George Kennan, former ambassador, and we broadcast those. We really went on in late January, early February of 66 for a half hour just to put it on at 10 o'clock in the morning. And it was so interesting and so important, and you were getting inside to the decision-making process that brought on our involvement in the Vietnam War, that we stayed till 11 o'clock, till 12 o'clock. We stayed all day. And we did that, and the other networks began doing it. And we stayed for X number of days, I can't remember now, 7 or 8, and suddenly they said no more. And they said nobody's watching. The housewives are not watching. Well, it depends which housewives you meant. Some were, some weren't. But the people in the news department, all my colleagues, felt that we had a responsibility to carry it, and I thought it was a professional news judgment to carry it. They said it's costing $250,000 a day. Today it would be $1 million a day. But if you're making those kind of profits, you have to give some of it back. And I think there was a day when they did that. I don't think that day is anymore. 60 Minutes makes a lot of money. 60 Minutes is an interesting program, and I watch it some of the time. I don't consider it serious journalism. It makes a lot of money. But, you know, we had a big fight once, management and me, about putting on the Pope's visit in 1965, about the Churchill. It goes on all the time. I'm glad there was such a thing as public television in the early 1970s to put the Watergate hearings on, because the only reason you had gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Watergate hearings involving the President of the United States, the Irvin Committee, is because there was a new entity called public television. And public television had the facility and the airtime to put it on. It was a great service to the American public. I had nothing to do with that. I just was a great admirer, and I was happy that public television was there to do it.
Fred Friendly is my guest. CBS News really had the reputation of being the most responsible.
I think
news,
it still is,
outfit.
Really.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because I think that reputation was really built by you and Murrow and
a lot of other people.
Do you think that its status remains the same, and do you think if it has that status, that it still deserves it?
Well, I think they still do the less bad job in the half-hour news, which is 22 minutes in news at 7 o'clock. I think that they don't do enough serious journalism. That which they do, with one or two exceptions, is better than the other people who do it. But I think the difference between the three networks is being blurred now. I think CBS leadership, and I don't mean just Murrow and Friendly, I think that after Ed died and after I left, Cronkite, Bill Leonard, the people who did CBS reports, Bud Benjamin, did much better work than anybody else. I think right now ABC is doing the better documentaries of all three, to the extent that they get any airtime to do it with. But they do some very creative work, and a woman named Panem Hill runs that unit. But they're pretty much the same today, and they're not good enough. And I'm not telling you any tales out of school, because all the people who work at those three people are all frustrated. They all know that. Now, you ask me about CBS News. I have to be very fair and tell you that for all my upset and occasional anger, especially over the events that caused me to resign, that I have good relationship there. They're my friends. But when they paid Richard Nixon $500,000 and then ran three programs of him uncorrected for all the serious mistakes of fact he made, that was the first time I've ever been angry and ashamed. I was ashamed of it. I was ashamed that they paid him the money. I was ashamed that they let a program produced outside come in with an interviewer. And even though the audience was told that it was an interviewer very friendly to Mr. Nixon, it was a precedent that I think they'll live to regret. I don't think they would have done it when William S. Paley was chairman of the board, or Frank Stanton was president, or Ed Murrow was the guiding force of the news division. I would have been in a rage. I wouldn't have permitted it to happen. We never paid anybody. I'm not saying never. I can imagine paying somebody. We paid, when we took President Eisenhower back to Normandy, we paid him a fee. But we asked the questions, and it was not an enormous fee, and we control the program. And I'm not against paying people for interviews, small amounts and all of that. What I am against is letting them control the airtime. We never, it wasn't my rule. It was a rule I helped to enforce, took outside packages. We turned down a lot of programs in the news area because there was a line that says this program is produced under the supervision and control of CBS News. I took that seriously, literally. That's all going out the window. And Richard, when President Nixon told anecdote, what President Nixon told millions of people that he should have burned the Watergate tapes, and that would have been all right. What he was teaching people was that it's all right to destroy evidence that might be subpoenaed. That happens to be against the law. It's against the law for a journalist to do it. It's against the law for Johnny Q. Citizen to do it. It's against the law for a president of the United States to do it. And he sat there and he said that, and except for one 2.5-minute piece that Bill Moyers did on the nightly news, you got to give him credit for doing that and for them letting him do it. There was no criticism. There was no... I thought when they put Nixon on that right afterward, President Nixon, right afterwards, they would say, now, here are some statements that President Nixon said which really collide with the facts, and these are the facts. But they didn't. Now, I know that some of the people at CBS, some of my friends said, well, all the American people knew that that was all false. They didn't. He made a fool of himself. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think a lot of people believe there was nothing wrong when they heard him saying that about him burning evidence. That's what journalists are supposed to do, is to put things into perspective. And if I say something that's not true or not accurate on this program, I expect you to correct me. And if you don't, Terry, I'll think less of you. That's what journalists are supposed to do. That's what newspapers are supposed to do. That's what television's supposed to do. And I hope that nothing like the Nixon interview, it's got nothing to do with whether or not you admire or don't admire President Nixon, that nothing like that will ever happen again. I couldn't believe my eyes.
So you think it was just done to get ratings?
I don't want to comment on that. Certainly ratings had a lot to do with it. And they would probably tell you, if you had them here, certainly the executive producer of it would tell you, well, they get to see the real Nixon, and the American people saw what a person he is. I think they broke a precedent which is as old as CBS News, not to let people interview themselves.
Fred Friendly is my guest, the former head of CBS News. CBS News has been called the most liberal of the news networks. How do you interpret that?
Well, I don't know who called it the most liberal. I don't really know what that means. If we were liberal, or if they are liberal or conservative, they shouldn't be, and I don't think they are. I really don't know how to make that judgment, and I would resist that phrase in my day and in this day. Now, the fact that Murrow did a program about Senator McCarthy, a famous program, several, and that I don't think that has anything to do with being liberal. It has to do with integrity and good reporting, and history has rendered its verdict on the Murrow-McCarthy controversy. But... I think a lot of people say that all journalists are too liberal. That's a criticism you hear every place you go. I would resist that, too. I think that what journalists ought to do is, this is a favorite expression of Murrow's, quoting Haywood Broun, to be accurate. Haywood Broun said the journalist's job is to make society itch. And I think that's what news people, including you, ought to do is... is to not let people make statements that are not true. And Senator McCarthy said there are 232, or whatever the figure were, communists in the state. Everybody knew that wasn't true. Is it a journalist's job to say there was no substantiation for that? And McCarthy knew that and said it to people on the plane coming back. If that makes you liberal, or if it's liberal to do a program about the migrant farmers and harvest of shame, then make the most of it. But I don't, that's not my, if you mean by liberal that you're way off in left field, or you're for you favor politicians on the left, I reject that. And I think of all the things you could say bad about any network, that's not one of them.
After one of the broadcasts that you and Morrow did on McCarthy, McCarthy demanded equal time.
Right. And prepared, we offered it to him.
You offered it to him. Okay, and he prepared a presentation
right.
for it. Well, how did you follow up that equal time presentation, assuming that there were some mistruths
well,
in it?
Well, as long as we're in the business of correcting each other, I
right.
hope. It wasn't equal time. Equal time,
well, fair is, okay.
equal time is what happens in political races when you have to give equal time. The fairness doctrine was what we had in mind, but really, Morrow and Paley independently said before we did that program, and we didn't tell management till 2 days before, we said, well, why don't we offer him a half hour time? So we offered him a half hour time at the end. We said, if Senator McCarthy feels that we have done violence to truth, he can have a half hour of time. And he took it a month later. First, he wanted Bill Buckley to take it, and we said the invitation is non-transferable. But he came on and he said a whole series of untruths about Morrow. I sort of hoped he would attack me too, but he ignored me. My delicate ego was bruised, not being attacked. But Morrow at the end of that program said, that was a statement, half-hour broadcast by Senator McCarthy. We will not respond right now because we offered him this time, but we reserved the right to do it at some later date. And Morrow went outside the studio. There was a news conference there, I think in the old Commodore Hotel, which was right near the CBS studios then in Grand Central. And Morrow just took him one step at a time. For example, Senator McCarthy said that Morrow had led an expedition of college students to Moscow in 1931 or 32. Morrow said, I've never been in the Soviet Union. I never went to Moscow. There was talk of an international education group going to many countries, including the Soviet Union, but it never went. And McCarthy broadcast tried to make Morrow out to be a communist and a fellow traveler and the leader of the, quote, jackal pack, unquote. And Morrow just went through the list, but he didn't use his own airtime to do it. And he did it, and it was picked up by newspapers all over the country. Now, people like Morrow and McCarthy, they don't really have to worry about access. They get all the access in the world. I think the people you have to worry about, the people who don't have access to talk back, talking back to your television set, talking back to your radio, the most imperative thing, element there is. And I think that's something we haven't learned how to do. We don't even do letters to the editor very well. The worst newspaper does letters to the editor. Television hasn't learned how to do that.
What do you think of the fairness doctrine? There's been some controversy about whether it should exist at all.
Mm. Well, it really doesn't exist anymore. Fairness doctrine really says, I wrote a book about it once called The Good Guys, the Bad Guys, and the First Amendment. Fairness doctrine says you will do controversial programs of public importance, one. Two, you'll do them fairly. Well, that's what every journalist, every producer says they do anyhow. Where it got into trouble was that the FCC tried to apply that rule to given programs when there were complaints. So you had seven men in those days, some women, on K Street in Washington deciding whether a program was fair or not. I don't think you could do that, and I think the fairness doctrine is not enforced on a case-by-case basis anymore. I'm not, probably surprise you, I'm not for repealing that because, first, it isn't really, it never was passed by the Congress. It's really an interpretation of the FCC. I'm for keeping it because you get stations like and I don't want it applied to individual programs, no matter how bad. I'm for using it to apply to a station like WLBT in Jackson, Mississippi, owned by whites, anti-black, would never let blacks on the air, kept blacks off the Today Show, put a sign up on the gate saying line trouble from New York when Thurgood Marshall was going to be on the air. And eventually, the FCC thought of taking the license away, didn't. They never gave a black a chance to be on the air during the whole civil rights struggle. And eventually, the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, in an appeal written by the then chief of that court, Warren Berger, who was not yet Chief Justice, took that license away in Jackson, Mississippi, and a group of blacks ran that station, and it's a complete new station today, and a very good station. It's the NBC station in that part of Mississippi, and there's only two or three VHF stations there. I'm for using the Fairness Doctrine for that, and I'm keeping it for that because you got 9,000 radio stations, some of whom wouldn't do any serious program if it weren't for the Fairness Doctrine. I'm sorry it's called the Fairness Doctrine. It really ought to be called the Responsibility Doctrine, which means to put programs on the air, not to try to umpire those which may err on the left or the right or which are maybe unfair to the pensions or maybe unfair to this or that. But I think the Fairness Doctrine is not very relevant anymore.
My guest is Fred Friendly, if you're just joining us. He's now a professor at the Columbia Journalism School. He's the former head of CBS News and the author of several books. You always insisted when you were the head of CBS News that there could be no relationship between the sponsors and the news programming. What's an example of an instance where it was coming too close?
Well, it never really was permitted to happen in the radio and the television news side. There are a couple times when people made suggestions, but William S. Paley of Philadelphia, to his credit, would never permit that, and certainly Morrow and I would not. Now, there were moments in entertainment programs, for example, on Playhouse 90, they did a program about the prison camps in Europe after the war, during the war, and 6 million Jews being executed, many of them by gas. And the gas companies, the Association of Gas Companies, which were the sponsors, asked the network to have them die some other way than by gas. So the word gas was taken out. And there are a lot of examples like that. But there weren't many in the news area. There were a couple times Mara and I would go to a sponsor and say, we don't think you should sponsor this program because it's going to be very controversial. We did that on Harvest of Shame, and we think it's going to cause you embarrassment. But they never would listen, and they sponsored it, and it did cause them embarrassment. The best story about that I know, a good story, has to do with a Pennsylvania organization, the Aluminum Company of America, which sponsored See It Now for 5 years, 4 years, and said, Mr. Morrow, you make the programs and we'll make the aluminum and we'll never tell you how to do your job and don't you tell us how to make aluminum. And we didn't and they didn't. And for 4 years, they stayed out of the newsroom, out of the control room, even when we were doing the McCarthy program, Indianapolis, Radulovich, a whole series of things. They were braver than CBS was and they stayed with us, I think, because they were a courageous organization, and they would even let us call up once in a while and ask if we could kill a commercial the night of the McCarthy program. We said, we'd like to kill the middle commercial, and they let us do it. So although there are examples of commercial companies intruding, there is the Alcoa example. Now, today there are no sponsors. Almost no program is single-sponsored, maybe IBM once in a while. Mostly companies just buy minutes, half minutes. And have nothing to do with the control of the program.
Which do you think is the more flexible way for television? Because, you know, on the one hand, you can say no sponsor has control, but on the other hand, you're always outselling, and the program has to be so saleable all the time because you're not insured that Alcoa is going to be the sponsor for the whole series.
I think that it's a very interesting question, and I'm doing something that you're not permitted to do in broadcasting, think on the air. But I think if it weren't that airtime is so expensive, that there are commercial companies, sponsors, who would buy better programming. I remember that The Voice of Firestone, which is a musical program, classical, was chased off the air because NBC wouldn't let them have ratings of that level. I think there are companies, and occasionally it happens even now, who would sponsor hour programs, 90-minute programs that didn't have the largest possible audience, but which they thought was good for their institutional purposes. But the networks and the stations won't permit that. I mean, if I were still in the television business, I'm really not. I consider myself a teacher in the springtime of my senility. But if I were still a producer and I came in, or Murrow came in with an advertiser, sponsor, who would buy an hour of serious news every night or every week, I don't think any network would take it because they want to sell that time for so much more money than the kind of program like that could produce revenue of, that it would be unacceptable. The big fight is not about the cost of producing good documentaries. There are dozens of very good producers at all three networks sitting there doing nothing. It's the high cost of airtime. And somebody would say, well, if a sponsor is willing to buy that because they're willing to take a smaller audience, we in the stations are not because it will depress the audience before and after that. So it's sort of a lost cause.
My guest is Fred Friendly, who's now the Edward R. Murrow Professor of Journalism at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, former head of CBS News and author of several books. If you don't mind my asking this, when you left CBS, you left over the dispute over a principle because you wanted to broadcast the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings.
But a bigger principle than that I thought that the job running the news department was the job for a professional to do, whether it was me or somebody, whether it was I or somebody else. And that when the commercial managers took over that decision-making, that was corrupting the whole process.
Well, here's what I would imagine was the kind of bind you were in. You know, on the one hand, you could leave in protest. But on the other hand, if you did that, then your kind of, you know, voice of integrity and journalistic integrity wouldn't be there anymore. I mean, I don't know who they replaced you with, but...
Well, they were very good. Richard Salant. And then him, after him came Bill Leonard. That's a question that's often asked, and some of my colleagues at CBS said that to me at the time. But, Terry, I had yelled so loud for so long and had, I don't want to say threatened to resign, but it was implicit that I would not tolerate decisions made just for the dollar, that at that moment of truth, if I had stayed 18 years ago now, I would have shot myself in the foot. I was going to use a more earthy metaphor, but I won't. I was, and I like to think I still am, a man of conscience. How could I do that? I didn't want to be a martyr. I love my job. It was the best job there was. But I had no choice. And had I crumbled, had I said, well, I was only bluffing. I'll do whatever you want me to do. You fellas decide. A year later, I probably would have been pushed into some other job. And I would be looking back on it and saying, why didn't I go when I knew it was right to go? I have Mrs. Friendly's, who's in the control room, and I have six children, all your age. Some are journalists, some are lawyers. They're marvelous young people. And David Friendly, when he was about 3 or 4 years old, he works for Newsweek today, was asked, we were at some company for lunch, and I used the words a matter of conscience. And another guest said to David, David, do you know what a conscience is? And he said, yes, it's a little voice inside your head that says, go brush your teeth. And I didn't leave so that 16, 17 years later, I could answer that question that way to you and others who asked me. But I knew whatever I had been given as a conscience or a soul would be punctured. destroyed if I didn't do that. I think, interesting, somebody told me much later that one of the people to whom I sent my letter of resignation said, I never knew the son of a gun, me, had enough money to quit. Well, that means that that person whom I admire had no concept of what that fight was about. But I did it. I don't regret it. I regret not being a broadcast journalist in that business all the time. But that's the way you live your life. An awful lot of people that work at CBS and NBC and a lot of other people were trained by me. I've had some marvelous students at Columbia. The producer of the CBS Evening News, Tom Bettag, not the executive producer, is a former student of mine. So I did, I'm going to sound like John Wayne, who said, a man's got to do what a man has to do. That's kind of a cliche, I suppose, for him or me to say. I didn't have any choice but to do that. Now, you could say if I stayed and fought from within, which is what some thought I should do, I don't think that would have worked. And I would have eventually ended up with a big desk and a fancy office and nothing to do.
One of the things that you did do when you left was help create public television.
That's right.
A lot of people think that it's not justified to have government funds at all funding public media. Why did you want to set up the system, and why wasn't the educational TV system that existed good enough?
Well, first, the educational system that existed then was hardly that. Many cities didn't even have a station. There was no money. It takes money to do programs, to do good programs. It takes facilities. It takes an interconnection like PBS. The reason that I was at the Ford Foundation as well as Columbia decided to spend almost $300 million. The studios we're in were made possible by a grant from the Ford Foundation in part, was because commercial television just wasn't doing its job. It was welching on its job, and there was no serious drama. There was little then. There was none now on commercial television. No serious music, no ballet, and no hour of news. Public television has enabled all that to flower. It's still starved. Congress hasn't given enough money. I think it's pretty well insulated from the government. Every other country in the world does something like that. The BBC is one of the best broadcasting companies in the world. It's not government money. I mean, government doesn't give the money directly to the BBC. And here the government gives the money to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is not in the broadcasting business, but which is a funder, a kind of government Ford Foundation, which has nothing to do with content. I was very happy when I was at the Ford Foundation one day to help save the Bill Buckley program and the Moyers program, two completely different points of view. And I think it's people in public television have done a remarkable job staying alive on a starvation diet.
Do you think public television is fulfilling its mission?
No. But I think it's doing much, much better than anybody has a right to expect of it, because it gets starved, or its funding gets taken away all the time. And if it weren't the ones who are saving public television, the American public, who send in money voluntarily to this station and the one in New York and the one in Chicago and hundreds of stations, the American people want it. I think public television, I think there's no better program than the McNeil era program. I think public television does better drama. The American Playhouse, Lincoln Center. I think public television is not fulfilling its promise only because it is so starved. It suffers from malnutrition. But it's the best thing there is.
Some people say that it's in a position where it can't really take political risks because it relies on corporate funders for its programming. And, well, there was some public television that many people would say Richard Nixon, during his presidency, helped to quash.
Well, I think he tried, but he didn't succeed, and it's not without some poetry that the Watergate hearings were carried by public television, the one thing that he tried to destroy. I think he still would like to see it destroyed. But, you know, some of the best documentaries and news programs are on public television, and I think they're—I don't want to say they're political one way or the other, because I don't think they are. I don't think good journalism, but they certainly do hard-hitting programs, some of which are very critical of a lot of American institutions.
You actually have a series that will be rebroadcast on public television in the fall.
Well, it's not really just rebroadcast. Four of them will be rebroadcast. Nine of them are brand new. They've all been done at Independence Hall. They look like television programs. They sound like television programs. And they're pretty good viewing. But they're not intended to be that. Their intention, and the funding came from Walter Annenberg, a man I never met till it was all over, is to produce some teaching tools for the classroom so that as we get near the bicentennial of the Constitution, there can be some courses in schools, colleges, that will make it easier to teach. Now, people will see those on the air. People will watch them on the air. I think they're very challenging programs. I wouldn't come back to television except to do something that I thought would be something that could teach. Murrow once said, it's a famous quote, "This instrument, television, can entertain, illuminate. Yes, it can even inspire and educate. But it can only do that to the extent that men and women are determined to use it for that purpose. Otherwise, it's just lights and wires in a box." So I hope what we did at Independence Hall, we had President Ford participate in these seminars, Archibald Cox, Justice Potter Stewart, former justice, Dan Rather, Tom Wicker, Senator Hatch. These programs, which use a Socratic dialogue method on hypothetical cases, will enable millions of people in thousands of schools and universities to learn what the Constitution meant when it was written, what it means today. And I hope millions of people watch it on television and then continue the dialogue that they start afterwards. We've worked very hard on them, and we haven't compromised at all to try to get listeners, viewers. We've tried to, my wife is, as I told you before we went on the air, the world's greatest fifth grade teacher, and she writes on the blackboard every year when school begins, "The job is to make the agony of decision-making so intense you can escape only by thinking." The seminars we did at Independence Hall, 13 of them, are intended to make people who look at them agonize over the hard choices that we have in 1984 and will have in 1987 when the Constitution is 200 years old.
I guess that gets back to what you were saying before about good television programming making people itch.
That's right, making them agonize. The greatest lines I hear on those seminars was when somebody gasps and says, "I don't know what I'd do."
Right. Well, you'll have a companion book coming out in the fall.
Yes, the teachers who use this, the professors who use this, are going to have two books, one of which was written by a colleague of mine, Martha Elliott, and me, which goes with each chapter, so that if you're reading about the exclusionary rule, you read Map v. Ohio, which we've written in a journalistic way, and if you're reading about reverse discrimination, you read the Dred Scott decision, etc. And it's a journalist book like my other books.
And that book is called The Constitution, That Delicate Balance. It's scheduled for fall publication?
Yes, it's all done.
Okay. that's by Random House. Thanks so much for talking with us. It's really been a great honor to meet you.
Well, you're a good interviewer.
Thank you.
I want you to promise if I said anything that any of your viewers think is wrong, that you put that on the air, because showing contradictions with a known record, and we're all guilty of it, is part of your job.
Okay.
And don't be afraid to do that. And I can't believe how long did we talk?
About 55 minutes, and we're running out of time rapidly.
Well, it was nice to be here.
Very nice to have you. And my guest has been Fred Friendly.